to giving me the opportunity to talk. I am supposed to make a very pedagogical presentation of a highly technical subject, so I will do my best not to bore the people who are not specialists and not to bore the specialists either. So, I think by now there is a lot of evidence that the ABS-CFT correspondence in the plan of limit is described by integrability. So the spectrum of the of anomalous dimensions of the theory should be coded in a set of beta equations, which are conjectured, wrote down, analyzed in detail. So the important thing here is that these beta equations are valid for any value of the Hopf starting constant. I will use here this notation for the Hopf starting constant. Later I will switch to another notation. G will be 1 over epsilon, but it is adapted for the g goes to infinity limit. So we have a set of beta equations which are able to reproduce most of the things, essentially all the things we know about the two theories which are put in correspondence, the n equals 4 supersymmetric EMDS theory and the string theory on ABS 5 cross 5 background. So these equations were written in the limit of long operators, but by now we have methods to reproduce even results for finite number of operators in the traces. So I think there is no doubt that these equations are correct. But the sentiment of the feeling of some people in the field is that we need very much a representation for the dilatation operator. We know what we diagonalize, but we know the result of the diagonalization of an operator, but we don't know the operator itself. So that's somehow my motivation to study this subject. One of my motivations is to find this this representation. Because we have to understand exactly how the change of degrees of freedom occurs between the degrees of freedom of the gauge theory and the degrees of freedom of the string theory. We have two different descriptions which are adapted to each of these limits. G goes to zero. G goes to zero is the perturbative limit of super-EMDS theory, and there we have a description in terms of an integrable spin chain. Where in the limit G goes to infinity, we have the string theory, we have a sigma model description, but in fact the true model is something which is more than a spin chain, more than a sigma model. And I think one of the important question is what is this model? What are the degrees of freedom? So if we want to understand why the correspondence work, I think it's important to understand what are exactly these degrees of freedom. So now I. Direction, I would like to remind that we the beta equations are written for magnons. They characterize the finally the momenta of some excitations which are called magnons. So a few, maybe 3 weeks ago, Matthias Stauder gave a talk here which was called "What is a magnon?" So I would like to remind that magnetic excitations, and the people who are on the other side of this door know very well that magnetism is a phenomenon which occurs in electronic systems. You have magnetism is electrons with spin in a, with strong Coulomb interactions. So the paradigm of magnetism in condensed matter is given by the Hubbard model. So the Hubbard model is a Hamiltonian. So shift the Hamiltonian of electrons on a lattice with spin sigma equals up or down. They are on the lattice of length L. So they can jump from a site to another. And also they interact when they are on the same side of the of the chain, and they don't like to be together. And this term gives mimics the Coulomb interaction. So. These are what happens with this model when u goes to infinity, or rather u over t, to make a parameter which is dimensionless. In this case, when if you have the number of electrons which is equal to the length of the chain of the system. this is conditioned because you feel exactly the half of the operations available. So in this case, when u goes to infinity, because of this repulsion, the electrons like to go one per side. So you there is no space for them to move. And you can see what are the fluctuations around this state which is completely filled, and the Hamiltonian which you get by reduction of this the Hubbard Hamiltonian is in fact the Heisenberg model. So you get as an effective model. This should be T over U modulus. That is the sum of exchange terms. S are now the spin operators in a spin half representation of SU2. And the excitations of this model are the magnons. So you see that in fact you get magnons by something with some fermionic degrees of freedom and constructing some putting some constraint. And I think the idea of many of us is that something similar should happen in this in the case of n equal 4 Super-Yang-Mills gauge theory, especially that we know that this Hamiltonian appears at one loop order in gauge theory, and in fact you can identify this parameter with 1 over g in gauge theory. And the analogy is not just symbolic, but in fact there is a lot of the structure of the Hubbard model goes into the dilatation operator of the n equals 4 gauge theory. This reduction goes here if you go to higher order in fact you get you get terms which relate things at a higher distance on the lattice. So you get by expansion into the interaction parameter, you get a long range interaction model, which is very similar to the dilatation to the structure of the dilatation operator in the C2 sector. In particular, well, there is this connection. You can get part of the dilatation operator by this projection. And there is also another connection, which is completely different, I would say, between the integrable structure of this model, the R matrix, which obey Young-Baxter equation, and the S matrix of the n equals 4 super Young Mills. So we still do not understand why this structure is here. You can see that if you send here the G to infinity, this is equivalent to U goes to zero in this model. So somehow when you send this Coulomb interaction to zero, you get almost a free system. It's almost a free system because, in fact, you are interested just in a part of the Hilbert spectrum of this Hamiltonian. You don't get all the states in the Hubbard model. They don't get translated into n equals 4 super Young Mills. So when you go to to large G, you should obtain some system which in some sense is simpler than what you get at finite G. So in some sense, this is one of the motivations for me to look at the limit of the beta equations. Now, what I wanted to say also related to the Hubbard model is that when you do this reduction to a spin system, in fact, you get what is important is that you get exactly the a spectral parameter of the which appears in the context of n equals 4 gauge theory, and this spectral parameter is written here. I don't know if everybody can see. So the momentum of the magnon is encoded in some rapidity variables x plus and x minus, which are related by which live on a curve which is in fact a torus, and this spectral variable in fact it's a double cover of usual spectral parameter which appears for example in Heisenberg spin chain which is given by U. So the relation between U and and V is Volodya calls the Zhukovsky variable, the Zhukovsky transformation, which transform the plane U into a double cover of the plane.
When you're talking about x plus and minus, it's a quadruple cover, isn't it?
Sorry?
When you talk about x plus and x minus, it's a quadruple cover.
Well, I'm talking about this, in fact, this relation. This is a
yeah, but if you have x plus and x minus,
Yeah, but via this transformation, I transform the curves which correspond to U plus and minus, which are this one, into this this curves here. So you see that for this curve you have two curves, and for this green curve you have two curves also via the image. So you have what is inside of the circle here is a copy of the, what is outside via this x to 1 over x transformation.
Are you suggesting that h is equal to h tilde if you include all the corrections?
On some states, on the states which are continuously connected to the states, in some sense, you start with the states which are exactly one electron per site. You follow them by continuity via this this evolution in G. So these ones go to part of these states, but you have also the states which are not connected. So if you want to use some language of condensed matter people, only the spin sector, you see here only the spin sector, while the charge sector you don't see it in this reduction. But otherwise, on the spin sector, this expansion is exact at any order in 1 over 2. Okay, so to come back to this dispersion relation, which you can get very easily from the Hubbard model. In particular, you get the dispersion relation of the magnons in n equals 4, this square root expression which was given first in the limit p small by Juan and his collaborators, and then was conjectured by Beiser, Dippel, and Stadler to keep to have this this form. So this data you get them for almost for free from Hubbard model. And well, what we are interested to see here is how this relation behave when g goes to infinity. So I represented here the curves which on which these parameters live. So I said that this plus and minus live on a torus. You can parameterize them in terms of elliptic function if you want, which degenerate. At some special points, they just degenerate. The torus degenerates into a cylinder. So these are the points g equals 0, infinity, and plus minus I over 4. And in fact, you get also from the Hubbard model, or you can see in the Super-Young-Mies beta equations, you see that you can have bound states. Extra bound states with which correspond to shifting this u variable not by epsilon but or by 1 over 4g but n times this quantity. So you have a bound states with similar dispersion relation as for the single magnon, except that you replace g by g over n. So in conclusion, you have some degeneracy, some singularity appearing in the parameter space for this set of points. So this explains somehow why g goes to infinity is a very difficult point to access, because if you want to make an expansion in 1 over g, the radius of convergence of this expansion is zero, because you have an accumulation point of singularities there. If you go around g equals zero, you have a finite radius of convergence, and everything is somehow easy. If you want to compute Arnold's dimensions in perturbation in G, this is easy. Put it in the computer, you can get the result. But this is not the case so for 1 over g. And one way to see is that when you go to this limit, in fact, your excitations have several, they are in several, they can be in several different regimes. For example, you can have a magnon which is in this regime where x plus equals 1 over x minus. So this is what Juan called the giant magnon. It's you who called the giant magnon? Yes. Okay, so this is the giant magnon region. You can also fall in this situation where x plus equals x minus, and this is the plane wave region also studied by BMN. And also there are some, the most subtle points are if your parameter x goes into one of these singular points where these curves come together. So this is also caused by Juan near flat space region. So if you want to look at your equations at g goes to infinity, you have to decide where your excitations live, which of the space, because in fact the momenta in this region scale differently with g. In giant magnon regime, you have p is a constant, something between 0 and pi, 2 pi. In plane wave regime, p scales like 1 over g. And in these regions, NFS, p scales like 1 over square root of g. And this is the region which gives the lambda to the power 1 fourth behavior. So if you have operators where for which the excitations lie here, you get this lambda to the 1 fourth behavior of the analog dimension. So if, when you solve the equations, you have to be careful about all this. Now it depends on the specific operators you are looking at, what you get. And in fact, one important case which was studied was that of the twist tail operator.
You said it goes like lambda to the 1/4, so that's like the massive string.
Yes.
It's like the Kubernetes string state.
Like the, well, yes, the states which were studied by Gutzel, Krebanov, and Polyakov.
Ah, okay, so it's always very large.
And also, I think the Konishi operators also scales like this, so yes.
Yeah, there are massive strings in flat space, so small compared to the range of ADS.
Yeah, right. So they're not semi-plastic things. They're really perturbative states.
We know that
in the Konishi operator
space like that.
Sorry?
We know that the Konishi operator
space. We think that. For example, one operator which surely scales like this is the one associated with the ferromagnetic acid two state to the spiky strings solution.
Quite a different state.
And any operator which lies in SPC2 sector with finite number of magnons or whatever, it should stay like this.
No, those would be BMN operators.
For example,
BMN operators wouldn't scale like that.
BMN operators, no, but the operators analyzed by AFS in their paper, Alutinov-Polov-Shaver, they scale like this. Okay.
They still have a large length.
Yeah, but this is not a problem. You can have a large length, what I'm asking is if it's known.
I mean, it's generally believed, but with maybe with the new equations that we have, maybe one can tell. Now I don't know if
no, you can have an infinite number of a big number of L's. And have this scaling, of course.
If you just follow the Kunishi operator to strong coupling, whether it scales like lambda to 1/4, I mean, that's
commonly
believed, but I don't know if that really has to be so.
So can't you follow it to a flat background and see what massive string state you get?
How would you do that?
I guess at these papers by Bianchi, people are good. Maybe in your own one of the papers.
Yeah, but we don't follow anything, it's the thing. We don't, it's not that they or we follow anything.
But you have this identification.
Well, it's a working sort of consistent picture, but we still don't know whether the Kunishi operator really goes to that place. I mean, I'm happy with that this might be so, but I just don't know it.
Okay, I don't really understand your concern, but if you take a state with in SU2 sector with L large and maybe an arbitrary number of magnons, large or small, I think you fall in this category, because if you analyze the limit of the Betanzas equations, you see that
Betanzas equations do not really apply. So
why?
You have to scale L like I think g to the 1/4 or g to the 1/2. I don't remember exactly. No, I think L should go like g to the 1/4.
And if you scale L, then it's also when you scale L, then it's
well, it's a problem because the range might be bigger, so you don't know L. I agree with you, but in principle, we need to know how to solve finite chains, and then we'll be able to answer this question.
Okay, but if you take infinite L and the arbitrary number of magnons, the leading behavior is lambda to 1/4.
Yeah, but you have to be careful that this leading behavior does not come from, say, the scaling of L with G.
No, I'm talking about the scaling of the L goes to infinity. Independent of
G. Well, again, you have to specify the orders and so on and so forth. What I'm saying is it's not non-trivial, and I simply don't know if that is true. I'm happy to believe that this might be so.
I mean, this is what you get from analyzing this equation, supposing that they are valid in this regime. If you have concerns about wrapping interaction, you may have concerns about it in the Casper, in the Twistel case, which L is really much less than the parameter you take to infinity. So this is the first place where you can have concerns about the validity of the equations. And It happens that the wrapping correction do not appear here in the result. You can take the L goes to infinity limit, so the asymptotic limit of beta equations, and you still get a good result.
That's just not Kunishi's L. Say, at weak coupling at least, it's L equals 4. I don't know what it becomes at strong coupling, actually.
Yeah, this is, okay, thing, so for this you have to use finite size equations, and the method of Bologna will hopefully tell us what happens to this operator. But generically, in the SU2 sector, I don't see how you get something else than G to the 1/4.
Well, except by BMN.
Except by BMN, but there, yes, you put them...
Yanni was estimating the size of the magnitude of finite size corrections.
Yes.
So you could try to see whether for the states they are big.
Yes. Yes, but okay, but this is, I mean, if you consider that these equations are valid, then you can compute the corrections which are given by the non-asymptotic equation. But supposing that these are valid, they give easily this scaling with the.
With the coupling constant.
So the case which was analyzed by Aretunov-Frolov and Standacher is clearly this the mechanism to get lambda to the 1/4 is clearly this mechanism. Okay, so I'm going to talk here more about the twist-tail operator, which it happens. It's very important to check the interpolation of the equations between strong coupling and weak coupling, because it appears in many important places, particularly in the scattering amplitudes of gluons. So the twist of the L operator is corresponds to a trace of the covariant derivative to some power m applied to one of the bosons, the complex bosons. So this is you mix all these operators, you put them in any order, so you want to see the lowest dimension associated to such kind of operator. It was shown by Korchemsky that a large Lorentz spin, the dimension of this operator goes like the classical dimension plus some function of g. Now, if L is finite, you have here f of g, and then a log of m, and then lower subdominant contribution in m. So this is the case for L finite, where you don't have any reason to believe that the few reasons to believe that the asymptotic equations are valid, but still you can close your eyes and apply the method and to compute this dependence of the anomalous dimension on G. Or you can have another regime where you keep finite you scale L as like log m, and you keep the finite this ratio, and then delta of g goes like function of g of j log m plus subleading. This is related to the Kasparov-Malas dimension, and it's called the universal scaling function. Where is it generalized? Scaling function. So this quantity, in fact, was used to fix the form of the Betanzat at weak coupling, and was computed at strong coupling. So strong coupling, it goes like. 4G, this was predicted by Gutzeff, Ivanov, and Polyakov, and then there is a 3 log 2 over pi. It was computed from the string side by Perlov and Tightly. And then there's the correction was computed by Reuben and Tightlin. So if I remember correctly, it's something like this, where this is the Catalan constant. So, and the lower order. So you have to reproduce this starting from the Betti-Ansatz equation. And now I will try to explain how you get this series expansion in 1 over G, which is not, of course, not easy to get. This operator in fact corresponds to the SL2 sector of Weishaupt-Staudacher equations. And you can write this equation like a product of, you scatter the excitations, the magnon, so this covariant derivative can be considered as magnon, and they scatter with each other. This is the scattering matrix. This is the scattering phase, which is given by was given by Z and Staudacher. So how do you extract the information from this piece of information from here? The easiest way to do is you put this term on the other side and you construct some function. So here you have a product over. Magnon, you introduce the self-interacting term if you want. So each time that this function z of p takes a value of an integer times 2 pi, this equation is a solution, either a solution of this equation, or you have an extra a p which is not in the set of the magnon, but there is an extra solution, and these are what you can call a hole, because it's a hole in the distribution of mode number, particle mode number, magnon mode number, which characterize the distribution. So you have the nk for the magnons, or you can have n k prime for hole. So how you distinguish between holes and magnons is that what you have at right is not p, this is the associated p to these numbers does not belong to the set of the magnons. So once you have this function, you can take the derivative. And this gives the density, the distribution density of magnons plus the distribution density of holes. So you can transform this set of equations into a set of equations for the density of of magnons and then of holes. So this equation can be written as, in fact, this equation can be written as row particle, row particle plus row hole of P equals some function of P, which depends, in fact, in the on the kind of operator you get, on the relation between L and M, in fact. So, but this is a known function, of the momenta, and then you you obtain a kernel. Which is in fact the derivative of this space. So, this kind of we use this kind of integral equations with Matthias to analyze SU2 and SU11 sector, but in fact the most useful thing to do is to apply to SL2 sector in order to get this important quantity, which is the universal scaling function. So this the corresponding equation is BES equation, written first by Eden and Staudacher in the case where this kernel did not include the dressing phase, which was not known at the time. So part of the scattering phase was not known, the most difficult part. And when this dressing phase was written down, it was possible to of course, to compute exactly to solve this equation. At least in perturbation, it is easy to do it. You have to specify what your kernel is. So, in the case of SU2 sector, the kernel is composed by several pieces. One is a part which I will call the part which appears when G equals zero in the SL2 sector. Then there are two parts which I will not write the variable, in fact. Two parts which come from the from the SU1 part. So there is a kernel which, well, it's written down here, but in a little bit different form. And then there is the most difficult part, which is the dressing kernel part. One of the problems with this equation is that, well, when you go at G equals zero, this part disappears, so you have to solve the equation just with this kernel, and the equation is singular, so you have to treat carefully the G equals zero case. This was done by Korchensky. You get some density at G equals zero, and then the idea of Eden and Staudacher was to write the total density as to decompose it into two parts. Well, take the minus here, log m over m, and some sigma of p. And this part computed by Korchensky, in fact, the leading part is also log m over m times some sigma zero. So in some sense, you just you can this is a constant number if I would rather switch from P to U via this transformation formula. So in the following I will use rather U, so I put a U here. So when U goes when it's large but not larger than m, so you have to be careful how you do your scaling. this density becomes a constant. So this function becomes log m over m sigma of u minus sigma 0 to the minus sign in front. And this in fact, if you look at this quantity, it's integral from minus infinity to infinity. Its normalization, in fact, is f of g. I don't put the constant. There is a constant part which multiplies. But I will skip it. So just the important thing is that the information about the universal scaling function is. Oh, I'm sorry. Now I have another function here. It's not the same. So in order to compute the universal scaling function, you have to compute the normalization of the density. Now about the these two kernels here, they are relatively simple. They are dependent on the coupling constant is given just by shift. In the original formulation of the equation. The functions which enter there are written down here, and u and v, the dependence on u and v is via this this transformed Zhukovsky variables. Y stands for the variable which is related to v, and x is the Zhukovsky transform of u. So. It's relatively easy to write these kernels. What is more difficult to use is the dressing kernel. The dependence on the coupling constant is very complicated at first sight. But Ilan Staudacher wrote a very useful formula which can be written symbolically like this. The dressing kernel is in fact a kind of convolution of these kernels with a function of this shift operator which shifts the variable u by epsilon. So here you can use the shift if you want. So at starting from this point, well, there were two different philosophies to solve the equation. So one is to go to Fourier transform of of the equation. So u goes to a variable t, Fourier transform. And then these dressing kernels are very simple, somehow simple in the t variable because this, all the square roots which appear here are transformed into Bessel functions. And this representation is very useful to use numerically. Several groups use this representation. This is the Klebanov you can one of Vena, Benvenuti, Cavicchio. Who proposed how to solve this efficiently? This and first analyze numerically the equations. Then Aldai, Altuno, Benna, Eden, and Cabano. Use it to predict. The leading curve for G in the universal scaling function, and then Basso-Korchensky and Potanski understood how to solve recursively these equations, and they used heavily numerical inspiration. So somehow our point of departure of this analysis was to understand the technique of Basso and Korchensky, but from the other point of view, from the point of view of the U variable, the rapidity variable. So on the other side, on the rapidity side, we use this rapidity variable, and then also Castell, Christiansen, Belitsky, and Gromov used the other representation. Castell and Christiansen use different method, so inspired from matrix model techniques. So their method is confined to G to infinity perturbative expansion. Belitsky approach is based on starting point is a Baxter-like equation. We started from directly from the DES equation from finite G formula. So but more or less we were using the same concepts. Sometimes without knowing exactly what. Was the relation between our approaches. So, in fact, what was useful for us was to understand that it is more important to work with not with the density of magnons, which you can Fourier transform, you can write an equation for it. But in fact, what is much better to do is to work with the resolvent. which is defined if you like the Baxter function approach. This is in fact the logarithmic derivative of the Baxter function. When you go to the infinity, infinite number of magnons, this becomes an integral on the support of the density. And here we know that the support is the real axis. So, and the jump of the of the resolvent is the density. So, And if you want to come back to this representation in terms of Fourier transform density, this is just, I think, minus I integral from minus infinity to, no, from 0 to infinity. So it's the half real axis Fourier transform of the density. This is valid for if you are in the upper half plane. So the resolvent is analytic everywhere in the complex plane except for the cats. So this is an object on which you can make complex analysis. The resolvent has a much better analyticity properties than the density. And in particular, in this particular case, it goes to infinity when we go to infinity. It goes like sigma 0 plus oh, what? Integral minus infinity to infinity. So it's the normalization of the density plus or minus the part which is constant at infinity. So you can read easily this the universal scaling function from the coefficient from the behavior at infinity of the resolvent. And now I would like to remind that in fact an important progress in the subject was done when people wrote the solution of the classical sigma model in terms of an algebraic curve. Volodya and collaborators did it for SU2 part and then for the whole PSU22 for group. And in fact, what the object which lives on the complex on the algebraic curve is the resolvent. So you have the resolvent on this algebraic curve, and you have the cuts which connect different sheets are just the cuts associated to this resolvent. So I think the important message here is that we can, if we are able to understand the properties of the resolvent at finite G, we have some information about how to quantize the algebraic curve of the sigma model. So in order to proceed from here, I will just like to remind that in this particular case the density has support on the whole real axis, so the cut cuts the real plane in the complex plane in two. So you have R of U, which is defined here for imaginary of U bigger than zero, and then this determination goes on the lower half plane. So you can analytically continue the determination from of the resolvent to the whole complex plane. So what I will call in the following the resolvent will be just the analytical continuation of the determination in the upper half plane of the resolvent. And its analytical structure will be important in the following. following. But now once we understood this, we still have to write the equation for the resolvent. Another crucial point, which help to analyze the equation, to write them in a simple form, was the fact that you can. I'm sorry, I erased the expression of the Dressing kernel, which is. Oh, you want to use this quadratic this form, which is quadratic in the simpler kernel, in order to linearize. So you want to linearize the equation. So symbolically, you can write the equation, the BES equation, like this in this is the SL2 at G equals 0 kernel, in fact, this part, the shift operator is nothing else than the KSL2. And then this is equal to here you have a 2. Oh no, it's k plus, k minus, then k minus. I will denote this operator by S to shorten it. K plus. So these are these include the shifts in epsilon. So how all this is applied on the density sigma? But now you want to transform this into a linear equation in K. You can write it like this: 1 plus. You put this operator on the other side, and then. -1 sigma. So you see that you make here a product. So you introduce an auxiliary density by this formula. Such that you put the other you transform this equation into a set of two equations, which are over tau. So you see that now the kernels appear linearly, but you do this at the expense of introducing an extra function, undetermined function. This is written in coordinate free representation, but you can write it in T representation or in U representation. This kind of linearization was done, in fact, first by Kotikov and Lipatov in a paper which is somehow mysterious and hard to read, and it is hidden in the middle of the text, so very few people recognize it. Then it was used by Eden independently, maybe 1 year later, and then was used by heavily by Basler and Korchemsky to solve their equation. They use it in the Fourier representation. So now, if you want to write this equation for the density, so you have to interpret for the resolvent, so you have two resolvents now. These two equations become, if you transport back shift operator, and you remember that here you have shifts which are also realized by this operator, you get something which is, maybe I should write this equation, but I will write this a little bit higher because I will. So this operator acting on R of U equals K plus times the shift acting on R of U and D minus 1 on H. In fact, it's not on R, but in it's here you have R plus H, so you introduce the symmetric anti-symmetric combinations by, I think, H of U plus or minus R of U. So here you have the equations for the symmetric and anti-symmetric part. And well, you, now you you can one important piece of information is contained in this formula. In fact, if you look at k plus and k minus, which are here, the dependence on U is via this variable X, which is has a branch unique branch cut. So now if I call this function lowercase r plus and minus, this function have a unique branch cut between minus 1 and 1. So this is somehow very important because you see that you can invert these equations such that R plus of U is a sum of the shift operator applied to this lowercase r function, small r. So you see that this unique branch cut gets translated all the way to the in the lower half plane. So you can see immediately what is the analytic structure of R plus minus of U. It is a series of branch cuts, a pattern of branch cuts which are separated by a distance 2 epsilon. This is epsilon here. The first one is the distance epsilon. While in the upper half plane, it is analytic as it should be. So now there is some more work to do to extract the information from these equations. The action of this kernel, in fact, on an arbitrary function, k plus minus u, is given by integral. Of these functions, which have in the way I have written there, the cuts of this kernel are all on the -1, 1 interval. So when you write, when you remember how you get this this information, of how you get these equations by shifting some contours, so you have to remember that this integration contour has to pass just below the cut here, -1, 1. And well, f has to be some function which is analytic and, on the upper half plane, including the real axis. Now, we have to understand what happens. We want to analyze the case when epsilon, the inverse of the coupling constant, goes to zero. So what will happen in this case is that all these cuts will collapse on each other and on the real axis. So what you will see when epsilon goes to zero will be something like this, just a unique branch cut here, and everything which was here was erased. So now you get yes.
What happened? I just didn't understand it.
All these cuts collapse on each other. So you will have a function which has a cut on the real axis, plus corrections which are. You can make Euler Maclaurin summation of over this function, and you see that you get something which is of the order of the exponential of minus u over epsilon pi, maybe. So you get non-perturbative. You get something which has a single cut plus exponential correction, non-perturbative correction.
Well, there is analytic everywhere except on the
country. This one? So. Yes. So this is what you see when you analyze your algebraic curve. You see one cut for one support of solution. You see one cut, and you don't see an infinite number of cuts. But what we are understanding here is that when you want to quantize your curve, you have to introduce all these branch cuts. And there is one important thing here I wanted to say, but I forgot, is that in fact this sum comes from 1 minus 1 over d square here, this operator which appears in k plus c minus in the resting kernel. And then, in fact, you can see this as a sum over, there was an epsilon, k plus epsilon, or maybe it was the other way around, k plus k minus, which is not really important. So, the important thing is that here you have a sum over these shifts, and if you can interpret this as a sum over bound states in intermediate channel. So this was in particular studied by Doré, Maldesen, and Hoffman. So they interpreted the structure of the Dressing kernel It was a part of the check of the consistency that this downstage should appear in the intermediate channel. So, in fact, these shifts are these shifts here. So you can interpret this cut as coming from bound states. So once you go and find a G, the bound states show up. And when you want to go back to epsilon goes to zero, they generate this non-known petals of the correction. So I think this is one of the main lessons to be learned from this structure, analytic structure of the of these objects. Okay, so to come back to the action of the camel now, in fact, what we want to look at the in the infinite coupling case is to see how to act with these camels in the case where the function, our test function is not any more analytic up to including the real axis, but to act it on a function which may have a cut on the real axis. You see that the integration contour is somewhere here when you want to act with the kernel. So this contour of integration will be pinched between this singularity and the singularity of the kernel, which is nearby. So the idea is to transform the action of the kernel. So you can, by manipulating contours and doing complex analysis, you can write this as an integral over minus 1 to 1 dv. So you integrate here. In fact, you want to integrate here, just above the real axis. So you have y minus 1 over y, x minus 1 over x. These are functions which have a branch cut. So you have the branch cut in y, which is here, but you want to integrate just above the cut, and then you can write it f equals to 0 plus minus f minus v to the psi 0 over u minus v. So you in fact, you transform the action of the kernels you can almost put it in a form of Cauchy kernel if you work a little bit more on it. But in fact, I don't want to bother you with technical points, but just the point where I wanted to come is that these equations now can be written. So this you see that now if you want to write the equation for some function, the equation k plus minus equals 0, in fact, this equation can be reduced to an equation for this combination. So you reduce the integral equations to monodromy equations, or functional equations. So minus v plus l 0. In fact, this is what we can do with these equations. And well, in order to exploit the structure of the equation, we have to make another definition. So make some combination of the two resolvents properly chosen, such that these two equations can be written as zero equals minus I so this is a new version of the BES equation. It is valid at any g. We made no approximation until this point. So the approximation comes when you want to solve this in perturbation. It's not easy to solve this equation without more input. So what is now I will write the first equation we use, and now the second equation is a symmetry property which will be valid minus g. So the symmetric anti-symmetric part of these functions in U is equal to to this function, and now g plus minus is a combination of the functions which are here, these functions which have a unique branch cut between minus 1 and 1. So you see that now this is a sum over all the numbers. So this is a function periodic with periodic in mu with period 2 I epsilon. So when epsilon goes to 0, this is a non-perturbative part. So if you are not interested in the non-perturbative part, you can say that just this is zero. And take this as a second part to your equation. So now you have to solve these two equations. And this is equal to g plus minus e plus e zero equals minus I plus minus U minus I. So you see, this is just a monotony equation around this cut. So you see that you make this monotony, you get minus I, so it's a fourth order automorphism, if you want. So what you see that this is solved by a function which has fourth order branch cuts on this axis. So now you go to the results. Well, the most general solution to this equation is sum over n in the and to remind once you know this. Well, the universal anti-scaling function is related to this coefficient. Just display this relation. Maybe there is a foreign one, if I'm not wrong. So now if you want to find the full solution, you have to find these coefficients, an infinite number of coefficients. So the clever part, I think, from the Basil Kozhensky Potanovsky work is to understand how to fix these coefficients. So now they are a numerical hypothesis come in play, into play. So if you want to translate it here, you can implement you have to check to see how this function, how this resolvents behave when you go close to this. So you wrote your solution everywhere in the complex plane, but now you have to come back and to see what happens when you come close to this point. But what do we know about the resolvents? We know that in fact they have this infinite cut structure. So what you want to do is to go close to these points. You make a change of variable to look at this. So now you have this is the axis, and you remember that you have this infinite pattern of cuts, which are now distance at distance one I to each other. So you have to this solution has to remember about this property. You have to impose the condition that it is the solution is regular at this in this near space region. So this, surprisingly, this condition is enough to fix this all the coefficients in if you work in a perturbation after the distance. So now to get back to this. How can you implement mathematically this condition? In fact, you have to remember that there are two kinds of functions. One category which has just one branch cut, and the other which has an infinite series of branch cuts. So this has an infinite series of branch cuts, and this has just this is a single function with a single branch cut. And in fact, when G goes to infinity, yes, I told you this G has a photo of a branch cut. So in order to implement mathematically this condition, what you can do is to go to Laplace transform of these functions. So you just I will write it again. You write the inverse Laplace transform of these functions. So this complicated operator. Becomes just a trigonometric function. Times the Laplace transform of this. So if you look at the analytical properties, this is analytic. Everywhere except it can have poles on the positive real axis, and this one can have poles, may have poles on the negative real axis. So analytic picture. Now these functions also can you can separate the poles. Some of them are on the real axis, some on the positive, some of them are on the negative real axis. So you can separate this function as parts. Separate the poles with the help of the gamma functions. So this one shares the same property like with this one, and this one shares the same properties with this one. So you conclude that for so this function should be analytic everywhere except zero or infinity, because this is the point which are left with this condition. So this function can be expanded in a Laurent expansion which is valid in the ring in every ring except so the points minus infinity, so infinity and zero. And now you're imposing what we know about this function, and maybe this expansion. We can impose this condition order by order in 1 over in epsilon. So we can fix it is possible to fix this coefficient recursively, which means that we can fix these ones recursively. So this is what Basso, Kolchenski, and Kotansky did this procedure until g to the 40, I think, 1 over g to the 40. You can go to any order in perturbation you want. Essentially, the same kind of techniques you can apply in the case where you have holes. In the case we have this parameter g equals twist over a log of the spin, so this is f of gj. So now a complication appears related to the you have poles which are have support somewhere between minus pi minus a and a, and it's very important to know how was the interplay between the singularities of this dynamic, well, kinematical singularities if you want to come from the bound state, and the singularity which are associated to the density of the holes. So if you write the equations, now you can take your equations and reduce them to the equation for part H of U, the development of holes. In the case where A is less than 1, which means that G j goes like exponential minus pi g, g would unfold. In fact, you what if one of the consequences of the calculation we did before was to show that the density of magmas here was exponentially suppressed. That it is zero between minus 1 and 1 is zero to any of the population theory due to this symmetry property. So the only thing you can have is this exponential part. So if you want to have holes here, the density of holes will be also exponential because you cannot create a density which is not given in perturbation. So this is the reason why when A is more than 1, you have this condition. So this was established by Basso and Kopchinsky. And essentially, if you are at values of A which are not very large, you can rephrase your computation of f of g and g and a as express that the f of g and f of j is just use just the information from the BS part of the part of the density which we computed on the previous problem. Surprisingly enough, in fact, if you rewrite the equation for this density, in fact, you get in this limit when A is smaller than 1, which is very important, you get the O6 sigma model, which was found in context. The fact that you have a part of the O6 sigma model was first understood by Juan and Fernando Aldari. You can see it from the better analytic equation, so reducing the equation to an equation for the density of holes. And it is somehow surprising if you think at better equations, because you started with an equation in the SL2 sector, and somehow you get another sector by O6 is a sector of the N equals 4 superiorly theory. So somehow this tells us that the equations, even if you want to separate them in sectors, the sectors know about each other to the high strong coupling. And I think that the mechanism in which they talk to each other is via this. You glue the different sheets which belong to different sectors, you glue them via these singular points which are x equal plus minus 1. So I think I should stop soon. I have to remember what I wanted to say.
You're probably going to summarize it, yeah.
Yeah. So so I think from here we can learn something about the quantization of the algebraic curve. Our starting point were the equations which are quantum in some sense, but they don't come from the sigma model. They come from the somehow they come from the gauge theory. So I think there is an important thing to understand: what is the connection between this quantization of the algebraic curve and the approach which Volodya and others are pursuing now to write the better equations, to rewrite the integrability condition as a set of as a Y system, as a set of equations obeyed by the Baxter, by the transfer matrix and the Baxter functions. So you see that the Baxter function appear here. These are equations for the for the Baxter function, in fact. We saw that in the approach of Bolivia, the bound states appear. So here they also appear via this set of infinite sheets. I think we also have a hint that about the non-perturbative collection. Somehow they should come from the bound states and the disappearance of this bound state when G goes to infinity. And well, somehow there is some property which one thing which was very important to this approach was that you can introduce this auxiliary density and linearize the equations. So the question is this auxiliary density, does it have a physical interpretation? Can it be used to make the contact between the spin chain and the sigma model approach? Oh. Yes. Thanks. Thank you for attention.
Do you see the crossing on this language, the crossing for the kernel?
Well, the crossing is an input because the crossing is the crossing is the dressing kernel is
bad. No, of course I know that it's crossing invariant, but say, can you formulate it in terms of some condition like for G, the crossing itself, what does it mean?
Maybe the crossing is just the Bernoulli condition on the somehow. I suspect that the fact that there are particles and antiparticles should show in this many sheets of the increasing of the number of sheets of the.
And also, okay, another question. What are the asymptotics of this function? So G is directly related to the kernel, yes?
Yes.
For big U's in the whole complex plane, and also
yes.
For big. As you, if you, if it is correct what you say that sheets correspond to bound states, so could you tell what is the asymptotic for very remote sheets of this function, of the value of this function, for any u?
Well, in the upper half plane, the total. Resolvent has to go as 1 over u. Now if you go in the lower half plane, since you have this pattern, you never on this in this direction you will never see a decrease because you have a periodic pattern. Now what happens here the function still decreases when it goes to infinity.
In this direction, yes, but
here, if you go this
and with the number of the sheet?
The number?
Of the sheet, say, you see the function?
It's the same function. Wait, you.
The values on different sheets can be different.
The value on different sheets.
That's what.
Well, yeah, this is a hard question.
Okay, we can discuss it.
Yeah.
We are missing this condition to fix the dressing kernel from our approach. Mm-hmm. So, thank you.
Small, say, sometimes interesting to study some double scaling limits near where some
quantum. I think this is equivalent to the double scaling grid. Somehow it looks like a double scaling grid. In fact, what you do here is to reorganize this, the perturbation in epsilon.
Yes.
Because you put the variable u depends on.
Yeah, no, I understand that it's a double scaling limit in that sense. What I was wondering is. So matrix models sometimes you take G positive,
yes.
And then you make it negative, and things continue to make sense.
Yes.
At some point, the partition function becomes singular. So here, similar with these formulas, can be for weak coupling, they can be continued to negative values of
yes.
G squared. At some point, for some particular imaginary value of G, they become singular.
What's clear is that when you cross these values, this cut will touch the real axis.
Right.
So I think it's interesting to study the system at these values, but I somehow was not able to. Indeed, some important information should come from this point. I think in the terms of the spin chains, you change the ferromagnetic to anti-ferromagnetic regime, so you anti-ferromagnetic. So you normally you have some information which you have to go up in the spectrum to see this information. In this case, you get it from the
spectrum. So we now know how to solve these equations at g equals zero and g equals infinity. I'm wondering if there are other points where you can solve them, or I mean, certainly zero and infinity are physically useful points to study.
Yes.
But this scaling function has different points, which might also be interesting, where something happens like along the imaginary axis in G or negative lambda axis.
This is exactly what. I think this is related to the question of what happens to when you cross one of these singular points. Singular points where the dispersion relation of the bound states crosses zero.
Okay, for a certain momentum.
For the least favorable situation where p. Sine p is equal to 1.
Yeah.
So this is minus 1. This is exactly this value.
But can you solve the equations at that point?
I don't know how to. I think it's interesting. It's an interesting question also, is the Hubbard model at this special point, does it have a special property? So somebody should study that one day.
But the Hubbard model doesn't have all of these points.
Oh, it does, because this if you remember the equation for the ground states of the Hubbard model is G0, something like 2GT, G1, 2GT, 1 plus something like this.
How is that?
This is the ground state. Well, it's this is the. The density of magnon, and this is the density of magnon.
But this E would be something like one coefficient of the dressing phase.
This is the energy of the ground state. And, you study any state, I think nobody computed the energy of a generic state, but the energy of the ground state contains, this is also the bound state. So you have the bound state in the Hubbard model also, and you have these singularities. There was a paper by some Greek condensed matter physicists who identified who saw.
This is just directly an integral. It's not. This is just directly the integral. It's not the solution of some inter-equation which contains.
Okay, but I mean, people saw these singularities for this function. There are many ways to see the singularity. You have bound states in the Hubbard model, and they have this dispersion relation, and the singularities are there.
Okay, I think we should probably continue in private.